on 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania, The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe.
Coming up today, Tasmanian dairy farmers who supply milk to Lion relieved at the opening milk price for the new season, which comes in above Fonterra and Murray Goulburn, as Fonterra keeps a lid on the price offered to a group of dairy farmers in the Riverina in New South Wales.
The 21 suppliers here in Wagga, we're a very small portion of the Fonterra milk pool. We are on a domestic pricing, unlike the rest of the Victorian export-focused supply chain that Fonterra has. So our pricing is more aligned with the domestic pricing in New South Wales and Queensland. It is much more around the commercial sensitivities, is my understanding, that they would prefer that we kept our pricing amongst ourselves and particularly until we better understand what it means for each of our businesses.
And Brazil takes over the number one crown from Australia for beef exports to China. Those stories after the National Rural News.
Hello, I'm Clint Jasper. An industry consultant says there's no clear reason why Australia's largest dairy processor has offered a significantly lower farmgate milk price than its main competitor this season. Earlier this week, Murray Goulburn announced an opening milk price of $4.31 per kilogram for milk solids, while Fonterra announced a price of $4.75. John Mulvaney from OJM Consulting says that on average, Murray Goulburn is paying farmers about 50 cents less than all other processors.
When I've looked at income estimations in the last 24 hours, in-pocket price sits at about $4.50 with the non-MG people, and the MG ones are coming out at about $4.
Fonterra and its 21 Riverina suppliers are keeping secret the dairy giant's offer for the new financial year. Suppliers in other regions revealed the price they would receive late Wednesday night. But farmers in the region say the prices being offered by others, such as the embattled Murray Goulburn, had them bracing for the worst. Meanwhile, some farmers who supply milk to Lion Dairy and Drinks are happy they've stayed with the processor. Lion has just announced milk prices across Australia, including southern suppliers, on fixed contracts, which are 27% higher than Murray Goulburn. In New South Wales, the price is 53.7 cents per litre for direct suppliers, which is 14% higher than Murray Goulburn's price. New South Wales South Coast dairy farmer Mark Honey says Lion has invested in flavoured milks and fresh dairy, which is paying off.
I guess they've changed their business model. They've a substantial market in high-value products, and they haven't even committed themselves on contracting suppliers.
Meanwhile, Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce has again defended his plan to move the National Chemical Regulator to Armidale in his electorate of New England. The move is opposed by farmers in the chemical industry and by the majority of Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority scientists who have said they would rather quit than leave Canberra. Mr. Joyce rejected accusations of pork barrelling and said the row will die down once the move is complete.
On all things, we will go through a process, we'll work with people. Armidale is not the back of Timbuktu. It's a university city. We will get over this hurdle, and afterwards everybody will be wondering what was the problem all about.
A prominent outback businessman says his decision to privately fund a new mobile phone tower in his remote town reflects a lack of government commitment to bush voters. Communities along the Oodna Data Track in South Australia's far north have missed out on consecutive rounds of federal black spot funding. William Creek publican and pilot Trevor Wright says the failure to deliver telecommunications to the bush has put outback politicians on notice this election.
They rebranded the NBN. It cost them $700,000. What difference did it make? None. Where would $700,000 go in putting in a small community such as Unadatta or Inaminka, just to name a couple in South Australia, where they could have got mobile services?
An inquiry into Queensland's labour hire industry has handed down a divided report, with parliamentary committee members disagreeing on how to tackle worker exploitation. The Finance and Administration Committee report makes just one recommendation and includes statements of reservations from both government and non-government members. An ABC Four Corners investigation last year uncovered unscrupulous employment practices in the horticulture sector and led to a number of investigations across the country. But President of the Southern Queensland Horticulture Group, Lockyer Valley Growers, Anthony Stutt, says a national solution is needed.
It's a hard topic. It's a national topic, so state inquiry is a good start, I suppose. But we believe it needs to be a federal system. I think if it's a state-based solution, I think you're going to end up with a number of different state-based solutions.
Murdoch University researchers have successfully bred plant resistance to 5 of the 8 known biotypes of the Russian wheat aphid. The first Australian discovery of the aphid earlier this year is worrying the agricultural community, as the pest can cause up to 75% yield loss in cereals. The resistance has been demonstrated on aphid biotypes found in Morocco, Turkey and South Africa. Researcher at Murdoch School of Veterinary and Life Sciences, Sarenjan Sarandri, says if the resistance is effective on aphid found in Australia, it will still take time to develop commercial varieties.
We are sending the material for the screening. If any one of our populations saw some potential for this resistant, then probably within 4 years, definitely we come up with one resistant cultivar.
For today, that's National Rural News.
On 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania, The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe.
G'day, welcome to today's Country Hour. Coming up, Lion announces its opening milk price for the season. And as the cattle markets continue to hum along in Australia, Brazil takes over from Australia as the number one beef exporting nation to China. That story a little bit later in the program with Richard Bailey as well. But first up, around 70 dairy farmers in Tasmania are breathing a sigh of relief today after the release of the opening milk price by Lion. Lion Dairy and Drinks has offered their dairy farmers a variety of choices, but the one-year variable milk price has opened at $5 a kilo per milk solids. Whose dairy farmer Grant Rogers supplies Lion and says the price is around what he expected.
Yeah, pretty happy, really. Yeah, no, look, overall, you know, very relieved. You know, I feel really sorry for a lot of people in the state. You know, fortunately, this time things have landed in a positive manner for us. For instance, for us, we'd probably end up with about, you know, 520, which, you know, for the current year, looks bloody good. But, you know, you've got to, you know, what's going to do next year, the year after, who knows?
What were you expecting, Grant?
Look, I was expecting something similar to what they've come out with.
How many suppliers in Tasmania are contracted to Lion?
I think there's about 70 Lion suppliers in the state.
And the relationship with that company, that'll be pretty happy with this result?
Quite openly, I've said in the past sort of couple of years that Lion is a completely different company to deal with than they were, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, and everyone remembers the battle their suppliers had with them at that point. You know, and look, they're a completely different company to then. And, you know, I take my hat off to them. We used to fight with them every year. You know, for the first probably 8 or 10 years I lived in this country, we had to fight with them every year over milk price. And the last, you know, last 3 or 4 years, they're a completely different company.
Now, that price that they've offered you, what's it compared to the price of production of your milk?
Well, again, that's an individual farm's. But what they've done, and I actually applaud them for it, is that they've put a number of options on the table for farmers, and they can pick and choose what they want to do, depending on how much risk they're prepared to take. You know, you can lock certain amounts in, you can lock certain amounts in for different time frames, and you can leave stuff on a floating market. So, you know, I really can't comment on that because every farmer will make a different decision. What they have offered is a lot of variety. It's still going to be tight, you know. I can personally tell you that when you're carrying a lot of debt and there's a lot of interest and stuff going out, that, you know, it's still going to be tight. You know, it depends on your situation. If you're sitting there debt-free, I'm sure, and you're a good operator, I'm sure you'll make good money.
And Grant Rogers, as a dairy farmer, it's been a pretty tough last 12 months with the weather conditions. I mean, it's been very dry, but at the start of last month, it was very, very wet in your area.
Oh, yeah, it was. And look, you know, we had some pretty big floods down here at Ouse, but again, compared to some people around the state, you know, we got off relatively lightly. And, you know, some of that was probably more good luck than good management. We just happened to not have cows down on the lower half of the farm that morning. Yeah, the weather is what it is. Unfortunately, you've just got to deal with it.
And how is it at the moment?
It's very, very wet.
Still?
It's like the whole state, it's incredibly wet down here. It's very mild. We're growing lots of grass. We've got very, you know, cover way above where it would be normally sitting at this time of year. But, you know, the cows are off the farm dry, and I suspect that stays like this. Spring's going to be a bit of an issue around around pasture utilisation. But, you know, that wouldn't be any different to, I would suspect, every other dairy farmer in the state.
So with that offer from Lion that you've got, how are you approaching the new financial year? With just a little bit more confidence?
Yeah, look, I hoped it was going to be around where they've come out, and we've budgeted. Look, our budgets have been incredibly tight this year. There won't be a lot. We'll be praying that we don't lose too many more irrigation pumps underwater like we did a month ago, because repairs and maintenance bills need to be virtually zero. So, yeah, look, we're in a far better position than most people in the state. I'll openly admit that. You know, there's been times in the past, sort of 5 or 6 years, we would have been in a far worse position. I consider ourselves lucky we are where we are in the current situation. Thoughts are with everyone else in the state that is suffering, and particularly those guys that suffered severe losses in the flood. I know a lot of people on the south have lost a few bits and pieces, but there's some guys out there that are really hurting. So thoughts with you all. Cheers.
That's who's dairy farmer Grant Rogers on the opening milk price from Lion announced today. The company has set the variable one-year price at $5 a kilo of milk solids. Well, dairy giant Fonterra, meantime, is keeping secret the offer to its 21 suppliers in the Riverina and has sworn the group to keep the deal confidential. The move came during yesterday's gathering at Wagga and is despite Fonterra making public its offer in other regions. Wagga farmer Simone Jolliffe milks 260 Holsteins and says it was not as severe as a cut as anticipated.
It's now in the next few days that each of our businesses will receive our income estimates for the coming year, and we'll be better able to understand exactly what the new pricing is for each of us.
Fonterra has requested that the pricing remains confidential. You look everywhere else, Fonterra itself has put out that in the south, $4.75 per kilo of milk solids. Murray Goulburn has come in at $4.31, Warrnambool Cheese and Butter at $4.80, and Bega Cheese at $5. Why is Fonterra not wanting the pricing to be known north of the border?
The 21 suppliers here in Wagga, we're a very small portion of the Fonterra milk pool. We are on a domestic pricing, unlike the rest of the Victorian export-focused supply chain that Fonterra has. So our pricing is more aligned with the domestic pricing in New South Wales and Queensland. It is much more around the commercial sensitivities, is my understanding, that they would prefer that we kept our pricing amongst ourselves, and particularly until we better understand what it means for each of our businesses.
What sort of price were you hoping for?
It's certainly anticipating a step down anywhere, given Murray Goulburn's price was 6 cents down in the New South Wales domestic price. We're expecting anywhere up to that. I probably personally was thinking that the market conditions would have left for a 4 cent decline, and it wasn't as bad as that. That was a positive for us, and I think a lot of people in the room are anticipating something to that extreme.
Is it also that Fonterra possibly, given the ill feeling generated by Murray Goulburn, and it's probably spread throughout the industry, and there's distrust in some cases between producers and processors, is Fonterra also possibly hoping that you'll keep quiet about the price in case there is resentment elsewhere in the industry?
It's not so much the resentment in the industry. I believe it really is just around the pressures on the domestic market at the moment, and it's extremely competitive with their customers. The Riverina Fresh brand is marketed into Sydney and Melbourne, into the baristas. It's a highly preferred product for the baristas and for cafes. And domestically and locally, most importantly locally, it's a product that has received enormous local consumer support. And they are showing us as suppliers that they are building that trust base with the 21 of us, that they are doing their very best to return that consumer support to the farmers and to Farmgate. And so I guess the story is that when consumers shop with their feet and shop local, that there are companies that will actually honour that and return it to the Farmgate.
Did you go into the meeting with the same level of trust towards Fonterra that you possibly would have had 12 months ago?
I would say yes. I think they've been very transparent with us as farmers over the last 3 years. They've been working really hard to build that trust with the farmers since there's been change in management about 3 years ago, and have constantly been very transparent with us about the business locally and about the challenges that they face, equally with the opportunities that they've been able to create for the business and ultimately for us as farmers and the local community.
The prices you've been given, and as you say, it's softening, so it's come down. Mm-hmm. Has that changed your planning for the next 12 months?
I was not getting ahead of myself as far as preparing budgets for the next 12 months. It really was up in the air as to what kind of pricing. The industry has been in shock for the last 2 months, and it's been very uncertain and very volatile as to where pricing would land. So I will be looking with my husband to do our budgets this weekend. We'll make plans based around that as to what the next year looks like, but it certainly will make it somewhat easier to do those budgets as far as considering where we need to put our dollars.
Fonterra dairy farmer Simone Jolliffe with Michael Kavanagh there at 21 minutes past midday on the Country Hour on the eve of the federal election. We'll talk food politics in just a moment.
This week on Landline, the farmers and fishers facing a contaminated future from the Williamtown Air Force Base in New South Wales.
Put all our money and time and blood, sweat and tears into it, but if this is going to make our kids sick, we'd walk away in a second.
And the Middle Eastern fruit gaining a foothold in Australia.
There's something about the pomegranate that it does get hold of you.
That's Landline, noon, Sunday on ABC TV.
On 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania, The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe.
22 minutes past midday. And by the way, tomorrow night on 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania, you'll get the kick and the count with Leon Compton. It's ball by ball, vote by vote. During our AFL coverage, the match between the Blues and the Magpies, Leon will be keeping you updated on the federal election count. So there's also continuous coverage on News Radio with RN's Fran Kelly on TV, of course, online and via the ABC Radio app. But we'll have the election covered right here on 936 ABC Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania. To politics of a different kind now. And a conference looking at the politics of food has been told that Australia's farming systems need to be better connected with the science of nutrition and health. Academics, nutritionists and ethicists are debating the politics of food in the conference, called From the Margins to the Mainstream in Hobart. Martin Strapper, a former CSIRO scientist and now biologic ag food consultant in Canberra, presented in one of the sessions called Reimagining Food Production. He's told Sally Dacus that means going back to unprocessed natural foods grown in biologically active soils.
Food politics to me means that the consumer, the eater, will have the right food that they can have a healthy life, because our current food is completely dominated by processed materials which have additives for taste and colour and shelf life. While from the natural process we can get, the farmer can create good food that is better taste, healthier and bigger shelf life by reducing the chemicals and fertilisers by natural processes and to stimulate the soil biology. Healthy soils is the most important part on planet Earth. Soil is the skin of planet Earth, and the soil has been degrading around the world. So with this new farming, we can actively manage good soils, and the produce that's come out of it is very good, and the yields are the same, so we get good food security with better healthy food. But there's a difference in the world that the science world doesn't want to study that, because they don't want less fertilizers and less chemicals. That's the bottom line.
So what's the connection between the farming system that you've described and the interplay between the politics of food? How would you like it to work?
Well, yeah, so like in the politics of food, like the connection between the health of the produce and the production system is not being quantified. So the science world always says, oh, what we do is good, but they don't test the results. But now more and more scientific papers appear in the literature, especially from the United States, from some scientists, that prove that the nutrient balance, the nutrient density of the organic food is far higher. But then in Australia, the science says, oh, food, organic food is only half the yield for farmers. So farmers count, that's why the price is expensive. But that's the old-fashioned organic farming. Old-fashioned organic farming is don't do this, don't do that, don't apply fertilizer, don't apply chemicals. And that's farming by neglect. What the modern organic farmer does, and we have many good organic farmers here in Australia, is to actively manage the soil, that the soil improves in health, improves in fertility, and then that farmer has the same yields as the neighbours in normal years.
What would you like to come out of this conference?
Well, the connection between all the disciplines, the connection between the production, the health and the nutrition of food, so that economically, because everything goes through economics, that it can be proven that if we eat that food with less chemicals and less fertilizer, that the whole environment becomes better and more biodiverse, and the eaters of that food are healthy, and we stop all the cancers and the chronic diseases, because the chronic diseases are a symptom of something is wrong in the food that we eat and in the environment that we live in. Too many synthetics. So the bottom line in my life is to reduce the synthetics. And in my household, I don't use synthetics. That's always a scary statement. I minimize, I avoid synthetics. And like we humans talking about avoiding is far better than don't do this, don't do that.
So how do you see a way forward? Does it need to be proven up on a small scale?
Yes, well, on a small scale, like the farmers I work with here in Australia, they all went this direction because of health problems in their own family. And because they have that example of chemicals hurting their family, they start doing the alternative things. And that proves right for them. They get very good food, they have more energy, and they're happy. So those stories have to be announced more regularly, that the mainstream starts to know it.
Martin Stapper, Biologic Ag Food in Canberra, speaking at the Food Politics Conference being hosted by the University of Tasmania. Talking there to Sally Dacus, 27 past midday on the Country Hour. And after assessing the last 4 years of data from trial plots in Tassie, Southern Farming Systems has a message for croppers. Think of yourself as a cereal grower. SFS has a number of grain research projects in Cressy in the north of the state. Trial manager Heather Cosgriff says grains should no longer be thought of as bottom of the pile compared with crops like poppies.
What I'm talking about here is for growers specifically in the northwest of Tassie who grow small areas of cereal, like it might only be 7 or 8 hectares, and they don't think of themselves as cereal growers. So when I'm talking to members and talking about being a member of Southern Farming Systems, they may say to me, oh, well, I'm not really a cereal grower. Well, in actual fact, you probably are, and cereals might be able to play a much more important part of your whole program in terms of their profit and in terms of their benefit to your system than perhaps you give them credit for.
As poppy acreage is being cut, what role do cereals potentially play in that context?
So in that context, cereals are a good, consistent winter crop. So we wouldn't sow them as late as you'd sow poppies. You'd aim to get them in autumn to early winter. Something that we're trying to encourage growers to look at is that long-term, cereals are potentially as profitable as poppies. You're not going to get those really big gross margins that you can get when your poppies all go to plan. But as we've seen in the last few years, the poppies don't always go to plan. Quite often you get disease or a bad season, which puts your gross margins much lower than perhaps you might have banked on having. And if we can look at the long-term prospects of cereals that we've grown here, we're getting average yields of 9 to 10 tonnes per hectare after grazing. So if you actually look at your grain yield and the grazing potential that you have of those crops, your gross margins are up around the $5,000 to $6,000 per hectare. And that long term, that's a good solid gross margin.
If people aren't thinking of themselves as cereal growers, you know, there might be a whole lot of research like what you're doing with SFS that they're not really absorbing. Out of the presentation you've done to these Northwest farmers today, what do you think some of the key takeaways are that you would want to impart to cereal growers who have now seen themselves as such?
Well, potentially, because there's not the level of irrigation up here, most of these guys are growing cereals opportunistically dryland. Probably one of the biggest benefits for them is it's a really good break for their vegetable program. So it's obviously, it's a break from their broadleaf crops like broccoli and cauliflower and even potato. And it's a crop that they can use to get the most out of what's been left in their soil from these intensive crops. So the work we've done down through the Midlands, quite often the paddocks we're working with are previous crops have been poppies or peas or another hort crop, and there's high levels of nutrients still in the soil. And so you can grow a 9 to 10 tonne crop of cereal on that without too much extra input. So you need to get early nitrogen on to make sure you get your root growth early. But then once it hits those reserves that you've already got in your soil, your inputs are reduced and you can get reasonable yields from without putting in too much extra.
Are there any drawbacks from planting cereals?
Well, on the northwest coast, certainly there's late disease issues. So Fusarium head blight's the common disease they get here late, which is truly a maritime climate type disease. But that's manageable with a good timing of fungicides. I guess probably the best thing about the cereals is that if you decide that you don't want to take it through to grain, it's still potential to be baled as silage, baled as hay, left as standing feed in your paddock for your own livestock. So it's got a really good fit in a vegetable type rotation.
It's late June. Have we missed the boat?
Potentially. You'd like to have your crops in probably by the first or second week of June. It doesn't always work that way, of course. We've still had good results from sowing as late as July. But all you're really doing then is you're turning a winter crop into a spring crop. So you might be harvesting in February rather than in January.
Are there any other key differences between what you've seen in your trial sites at Cressy and what the farmers in the northwest region experience?
Oh, definitely. The soil issues here are different. So drainage and waterlogging is a real issue in the Midlands area where we are. The soils up here tend to be more free-draining, but of course we've also got a bit higher rainfall up here too, so timing of getting things on your paddock up here can be a lot more difficult than for the guys who can just turn the tap on and irrigate when they want to. But probably the biggest issue is the difference in growing season and the difference in the diseases that they face. So early disease probably isn't as much of an issue up here because most of the crops aren't sown until May or June, but late disease is, which is kind of the opposite to what we see down through the Midlands. With cereals, it's about getting the optimum yield, not necessarily the highest yield. So Southern Farming Systems, and this is really where George should come in, ran the crop competition down for the Midlands Ag Association this year. And what we found from that is that the people who had the highest gross margins weren't the people with the highest yields, weren't the people with the most inputs, weren't the people with the cleanest crops in terms of weed or disease, but they were the people who managed their crops by putting on their nitrogen based on the season, not based on what they always do. And so I guess really it's not about being perfect and having the highest yield, it's about managing your crop for the season and getting the optimum yield for what you can do, not the highest yield.
How would you have managed your nitrogen for the season just gone?
Probably the best start is know what you've got in the bucket. So I'd really encourage people, if they're not already, to do a pretty simple soil test. So take a test down to at least 20 or 30 centimetres to see how much nitrogen you've got in the root zone at the start of the season. And if you've got levels, you know, above 150 or 200 kilos per hectare, you can really modify how much nitrogen you put on. Just really apply nitrogen based on the rainfall. So if it's looking like a good season and you're getting plenty of rainfall, put out plenty of nitrogen. If it's drying off in the spring like it has in the last couple of years, well, don't put any more out. And you can really manage your inputs that way.
Heather Cosgrove from Southern Farming Systems speaking there to Margot Kelly. 24 minutes to one. Let's check the weather now. And Tim Bolden joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Tim.
G'day, Tony. How's it going?
Yeah, good. The rainfall gone for the time being?
Yeah, we did see rainfall pretty much statewide yesterday, but not much really reached the east and southeast, or at least that registered in the gauges. Highest totals were very much in the north and the west, with 47 millimetres at Mount Victoria, 46 at Quambie Bluff, 42 at Railton, 37 at Elizabethtown, Barrington 36, generally around the 10 to 30 millimetre mark for the remainder of the north and west, but less than 5 millimetres throughout the southeast, with most places actually seeing zero.
Okay. And the outlook as we head towards a weekend?
Well, we're currently in a westerly stream, though we do have a cold front to approach us during the course of tomorrow that will see that shift a little bit more northwesterly. At the moment, we're seeing some showers about the west, far south and Bass Strait. Into tomorrow, as that flow shifts northwesterly, though, we may just see something push along the north coast as well. Otherwise, looking at fine conditions today and tomorrow, with just the slight risk of some morning fog tomorrow. Into Sunday, though, we have that front move over us, mostly later in the day, but those showers extending right through the north and the west during the morning, and then to most of the state into the afternoon and evening as that front crosses, although very little reaching the east coast, particularly around the Swansea-St Helens area. That front will then weaken into a trough, which will linger about the northeast on Monday, with showers statewide, but gradually contracting to the west, south and northeast. Into Sunday night, behind that cold front, we will see the snow line drop down to around 800 metres by Sunday night and then bottom out at around the 600 metre mark on Monday, so becoming quite cold later on Sunday as well.
Any warnings, Tim?
A couple of warnings. For today, just a strong wind warning, southern coastal waters, Tasman Island to Low Rocky Point. For tomorrow, strong wind warning for southern, western and northern coastal waters from Tasman Island to St Helens Point, but that does exclude the central north. And for tomorrow, there is also a small craft wind alert for southwest lakes.
And for those going out in the waters at the weekend, the coastal waters and swell.
We're in a westerly flow at the moment, around 15 to 25 knots, a bit lighter about the east, but reaching 30 knots about the south. That shifts west to northwesterly overnight and increases to 20 to 30 knots about the west, as well as remaining at 20 to 30 knots about the south. And then into the evening, we will see it increase to 20 to 30 knots about the northeast, with northwesterly winds further increasing ahead of the change, generally up to 20 to 30 knots early Sunday, but locally 35 knots about the south, but coming round west to southwesterly at 15 to 25 knots behind the change, but that's really only affecting the west and south by midnight. As far as the swell goes, the wave rider is currently on 4.2, peak of 6.9, and that's with a 12-second period, and we're looking at a west to southwesterly around the 3 to 4 metre mark today, but staying around 4 metres tomorrow, then peaking up near 5 metres on Sunday. For the north, a westerly at 1 to 2 metres, and for the east, a southerly 1 to 2 metres, but reaching 3 metres offshore in the south later on Sunday as we see things build behind the change.
Good on you, Tim. Thanks for that.
Sure thing.
See you later. Tim Bolden from the Bureau. 21 minutes to one. There are moves to a statewide Tasmanian planning framework as well as a rolling series of changes to local council planning rules. This week, hearings have started to assess almost 300 submissions on the draft Tasmanian planning provisions, including lots from people and organisations with land and water management concerns. Principal lawyer with the Environmental Defender's Office, Jess Feely, says she wants to flag a couple of issues on public and private land.
So the draft state planning provisions, which will form the statewide rules, were out for public comment earlier this year. There were 295 submissions made, a lot of them quite detailed and quite strong. Lots of submissions from councils themselves raising concerns about the process and whether or not a sort of statewide standardisation actually achieves better outcomes or whether there is a need for more local variation. The Planning Commission is now holding hearings and giving those people who did make representations an opportunity to speak to their representations and explain their concerns. Those hearings are expected to probably go through July and August, following which the Commission will make a recommendation to the Minister, and then the Minister will declare or, depending on the recommendations of the Commission, go back to the drawing board and either make significant amendments or start from scratch again with the statewide planning provisions.
The sort of cases that come to the Environmental Defenders over land and water planning, what are the main areas that you'd be looking for change?
One of the key concerns we raised in relation to the draft was around the Natural Values Code for assessing any development which is likely to have an impact on water quality, biodiversity, habitat. And one of our concerns was around the broad-ranging exemptions from that code. So under the proposed statewide planning provisions, any agricultural activity, any activity on cropping pasture land, any forestry activity, any number of activities were actually exempt from the requirements of the Natural Values Code. So that was something that we raised as a concern.
Why?
Because the application of that code, not only does it mean that activities may go ahead that have inappropriate impacts, but it's also much harder to monitor what's actually going on within a council area if a whole range of activities aren't being required to get a permit. You just don't have that record of how much habitat loss is occurring across the state or across the municipality, and ultimately what impacts that might have at a broader scale.
I've heard many farmers who've gone through this sort of process, whether it's for new developments or a change to a more intensive industry, that they're funding the assessor's industry, bills of tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Look, I would be the first to sympathise with that and to acknowledge that there are definitely improvements that can be made in the system to ensure that developments which don't need that level of assessment aren't required to jump through those hoops. I think the breadth of the exemptions that are proposed did run the risk of there being developments which needed to be assessed not being assessed, but there's definitely an opportunity as part of this planning reform process to look at that and make sure that only those developments which need that level of assessment are getting that level of assessment, but also developments that do need that level of assessment are required to do it. So it's definitely a balancing act, and I do sympathise with those developers, whether they're farmers or other developers, who do feel like it's an unnecessary burden, but there are also those situations where it's absolutely essential that that level of assessment occurs.
Are there other glaring exemptions from your reading of the draft so far?
One of the other major concerns, certainly that we have and a number of other people that made representations, is around the reserve activity assessment process for developments in parks and reserves. If the Parks and Wildlife Service grant an approval to a development, it will be treated as permitted and it won't be advertised and available for public comment and subject to assessment by the planning authority and the opportunity for third-party appeal. Again, there's a case for avoiding duplication, but the process that the Parks and Wildlife Service currently go through is not legislated, doesn't guarantee public involvement, and it doesn't guarantee that a particular set of criteria will be used to assess a development. So where the development is in a public national park or reserve and really should be subject to transparency and public participation, that's a concern and certainly something that we raised, and we would like to see the planning scheme altered to ensure that developments in national parks, public places, are subject to a higher level of public participation.
You see and you hear these disputes at the moment, some of them. They're very emotional, the ones that I hear about. So is this a fundamental conflict of values?
I think this is one of the things that's really important about the planning process, is the role that council has avoiding land use conflicts before they arise. So there will always be a level of emotion in any sort of conflict between neighbours about the way that they're using their land. You can't legislate out of that. But if the planning system sets it up so that you avoid that situation in the first place, and those kind of land uses which will inherently be in conflict are avoided by not allowing them to occur next to each other. If, for example, someone is moving into a rural area, whether the contract of sale should make very clear the kinds of activities that occur in that area so that they're well aware of what they're getting into and the kinds of noises, dust, chemical spraying that they would be expected to experience just by virtue of the area that they're moving into, that can also have a big impact in dealing with those conflicts by just being absolutely clear right from the outset what someone would be expected to put up with in an area that they're moving into.
So given that we've got the directions hearing and then the more rigorous hearing process, what are the opportunities still for people to get involved?
So at this stage, only those people who've already made comments are invited to speak at the hearing. But once the statewide planning provisions are declared, it's then up to each individual council to develop local provision schedules which set the rules for land in their area. So what zone is applied, what the rules are within that zone, will have a real impact on what people can do on their land and also what can happen in areas near their land that may impact on what they do on their land. So I think it's really important when the local provision schedules are advertised, at this stage looks probably like early next year, for people to have a look at those and really think about whether the zone that's applied to their land allows them to do what they want to do on their land, and whether it imposes any restrictions either on what they can do or on what people may complain about them doing if they're allowed to carry out activities nearby. So I think it's really important that people do look at those, have a think about whether it is something that might impact on their operations, and if it will, then to make some comment about that, and they'll be given an opportunity to make comments and then to appear at a hearing next year if they're concerned.
That's Jess Fee, Principal Lawyer with the Environmental Defenders Office, speaking to Rose Grant about changes to planning laws in Tasmania. 14 minutes to one. We'll take it to King Island very shortly, where a bloke who's decided to build a caravan is actually doing it, rather than the cost of shipping it from the mainland or from Tasmania. And we'll also have Richard Bailey along with the latest on the livestock markets. But to the beef market now, and Australia has lost the crown as the number one beef exporter to China as the Chinese seek cheaper imports from Brazil and Uruguay. Australian beef exports have dropped by 41% in May compared to May last year, with the biggest falls in grass-fed and frozen beef. Lockie Hart, the new chair of the Australian Meat Industry Council and managing director of Stockyard Beef, says the South Americans beat us on price, so Australia has to focus on quality. He's speaking here to Serena Locke.
Brazil and Uruguay have been significant exporters to the Chinese market for many years now. Look, admittedly, a lot of it is going through the grey channels in the past. They've now got greater access through the front door. They've got a market niche in the Chinese market for that low-cost, low-value, low-quality frozen product. The Chinese are looking at accessing some cheaper product for their consumers.
So you say some of it has come through the back door from Brazil and Uruguay into China and now goes through the mainland channels. How is that possible? What have they done?
Well, it's all about market access. You know, we, as you probably know, have secured a free trade agreement with China. I think there's a queue a mile long of countries lining up to access that a very important market. You've got to understand that there's been a lot of hype around China. It has been for some time. And without undermining the importance of that market to the Australian beef industry, what we're actually seeing at the moment, which is the cause of the drop in the export volume to that market, is the fact that our price of beef has gone up quite substantially over the last 12 months. And there are other markets now prepared to pay a lot more money for our beef.
Well, picking up on what you say, does it put a downward pressure on Australia's beef price then?
I don't think that's going to happen, not at all. You know, we are in a grip of a supply shortage.
Globally?
Globally, there's, again, we're in a cycle. Things in Northern America are changing slowly. There's going to be increased production coming out of Northern America over the next 3 years. Brazil and Uruguay are starting to ramp up their production. In saying that, though, the demand for beef globally continues to increase. And as long as the prices don't go through the roof, causing consumers to change their buying behaviour to look at other proteins, I suspect that demand's going to continue and continue to drive cattle prices back here in Australia.
But it is a big competitor, Brazil, and Uruguay as well. So if Brazil is now supplying more than 30% of China's beef imports, how has it got to this stage? What's happening in Brazil?
Brazil's just has the ability of turning the tap on. They have enormous production capacity. They can turn country into very high productive beef production outlets. When they do things, they certainly do it in a big way. We've been competing against Brazil in many of our traditional markets for a long, long time. I suppose we've had some better access because of our clean green image and our disease-free status into certain markets. But Brazil's always been there and will always be there in the future. I think Australia and what we as an industry need to do and what we are definitely doing is moving ourselves out of that commodity market and into a high-quality, high-paying market. And, you know, I've seen that's what is actually happening at the moment.
Lockie Hart, the new chair of the Australian Meat Industry Council, managing director of Stockyard Beef, talking to Serena Locke about the global demand for beef and how Brazil has the capacity to deliver.
The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe.
Here we are, front afternoon. Let's look at the livestock markets and say g'day to Richard Bailey. How are you, Richard?
Very well, Tony. How are you doing down there?
Yeah, pretty good. Much election talk at the sale yards? Or is it all about sheep and cattle?
Yeah, no, I didn't write a big mention. Mainly about sheep and cattle prices and where they're likely to go and how steamy the store sales are, any store cattle at all, just at the end of the killer fatty sale on Tuesday. We saw some store cattle just make ridiculous money. And last Thursday at Piranha, there were some extraordinary sales, and right across eastern Australia the same. So that's been the talking point, interstate and here, I suppose. But the eastern states young cattle indicator by Tuesday night had got to 655 cents. There are people saying it might get to 700 cents. I would hope not, and it's probably unlikely. But anyway, we'll wait and see on that one. What's happening is that there's very few cattle at all selling under 300 cents a kilo. So most of your yearling and good quality yearlings through most of the sale yards in Victoria and New South Wales are making somewhere between 330 and 370 cents a kilo. And then you get over into the bullock department and you... most of the bullocks, 345 to 375 cents a kilo, which is meaning a huge number of bullocks making over $2,000 a head. And the cow prices, same. Our cow prices in the Northern Midland sales on Tuesday were the best they've been for a long time. Not quite as high as they were at Wagga, Pakenham, Camperdown, all those areas, Shepparton. Most of the better beef cows made 255 to 298 cents a kilo. A lot of dairy cows, 225 to 265 cents. And the very poor cows, very poor dairy cows, 165 to 225 cents. Not many cows making under 200 cents a kilo, and that's including a lot of dairy cows. So those that have decided to sell cows at the moment are getting out very, very well. And it's just, it'd be fascinating to see where this goes, because they're all saying that, you know, the American market's tough enough, but they must be making some money if they're paying that sort of money for them.
Yeah, and we see we're doing that story today about how Brazil's taken over with the beef capital of the world at the moment.
Oh, yeah, I think I said when I came back from Sydney last time after being with the reporters that I don't think I realised how big their breeding herd was. Extraordinary number.
Let's look at the lamb market now.
Well, it's just kept on buzzing away. Hard to know where it'll go. Just interesting to note that during the week, Swift bought out for Bordertown and Cobram their prices up until the end of the year, their forward prices, and they're sort of around that $6 mark at the moment, then back to $5.80, and their worst prices in November where it's $4.80 cents a kilo. So they are obviously pretty confident that it's going to stay pretty well up there for a while. The $4.80 that starts on the 13th of November and goes through until December, it's because that's the sort of cut-off period for shipping to America to get there by Christmas. And then, of course, when you get a little bit closer to Christmas, then, you know, your shipments are getting there in the new year. So that's the reasoning behind that. The other reason is, of course, that's the peak of the spring lamb season too. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But there are a huge number of lambs at the moment in Victoria and New South Wales markets that are making anywhere from sort of 630 up to 670 or 80 cents a kilo, which is meaning that there's a lot of lambs making over $150 a head, which is terrific for people that have kept their lambs through the winter, because I reckon you need to get paid pretty well.
And people have kept their sheep.
Yeah, mutton very much the same. I mean, there's a lot of mutton making $4 and better a kilo, which is meaning, you know, $80 to $120 for decent ewes and wethers. So very exciting times for producers. I don't think nearly as exciting times for processors and exporters, and little butchers, I think, are feeling it.
We'll be in spring before we know it.
We will. And the word is that spring lambs will be around a bit earlier than normal. Their season in northern Victoria, southern New South Wales has been pretty good. I reckon by another 2 to 3 weeks, we'll see some decent numbers of spring lambs at Bendigo, Shepparton, Wagga and those sort of places. So that'll be interesting times.
And before we know it, we'll be planting tomatoes, Richard.
How are your broad beans looking?
Going well. Hello. They're popping up all over the place, mate, and just saying g'day.
Have a good weekend.
You too. See you, mate. Yeah, Richard Bailey back next Wednesday on the Country Hour to check the latest on the lamb and cattle markets at 1:05. And finally today, we heard earlier this week that King Island is a step closer to getting a new shipping service next year, with twice weekly trips between the island and mainland Tasmania. Nonetheless, everything needs to be shipped in or shipped out. So what do you do if you're after a new caravan? You build one on the back of a kelp trailer. That's what King Island resident Andrew is doing for his wife Diane, building her an art studio caravan from scratch. Margot Kelly at least visited the construction site as the final pieces were being glued together.
Oh, are you looking up and down?
If I make that parallel, it'll be pretty good. Dabby?
So what needs to be fixed?
A
glue it now. It's got to be glued, and then we'll nail it off. The glue will provide a lot of stability for it. It'll help to brace it up, which is important. We don't want it to blow away in the King Island breeze.
Yeah, I'm Andrew Blake. We're building a studio on wheels for Diane. In the house, it's not big enough anymore.
Why are you deciding to build it?
Why am I deciding? To save money. To save money. Building's not a bad idea. You know, I enjoy a bit of building and very appreciative of being in Jim's shed here and with his technical assistance and whatever. We get the measuring right.
It's about 4 metres long and about 2.5 metres wide. It's going to be about 2.3 metres inside, so it'll be nice and high. It's got plenty of windows. And Di will be very comfortable and warm and dry when she paints. It's made out of timber. It's built on an old kelp trailer. And I've just basically built a structure like you would for a small house. And Andrew's doing a lot of work. I'm just driving the project, to be honest, I suppose.
Out of the three little piggies who want to build a studio on King Island...
This is the one made of sticks. This is the one made of sticks. Not straw. It's not brick.
So how do you make sure this can stand up to the test?
Once it leaves here, I don't care.
Lots of nails, lots of glue and keeping things square, but it must be said that it doesn't always blow here on King Island. It's a perfect day out there today, and, it blows from time to time, but the beauty of this place is that it doesn't all the time, and it's lovely to be here.
How much is the DIY culture a part of King Island?
Oh, it's always been a part of my culture, and we've always lived a bit remote, so I'm not quite sure actually how big the DIY is here. But, there are certain levels of practicality that you have to live on a place like this.
But you don't just live here. Can you tell me about what it's like living between, or having lived between King Island and the Far North?
It's arduous in the sense that, you know, there's a lot of travelling, you know, a commute 3,500 kilometres. But I must say that we're very fortunate to be able to do it. You know, our expertise is in the arts of the top end, the Indigenous arts. And we spent, most of our adult life together, you know, living in these communities. So we're very fortunate to be able to go back up.
Two temperatures too. Do you get sick going between the two, I would imagine?
One of the reasons why we came down to King Island was that we were getting tired of being hot every day. You're not cold every day down here. And as my old mum said, you know, you can always make yourself warm. It's a little bit difficult to cool yourself down at times.
Very true.
If you bought this caravan off in Victoria and brought it onto the island, it cost you $2,500 in transport. So Andrew will get this basically for what it would cost him for the transport. It's a huge issue on King Island. It's one that we're all concerned about. We're losing our ship at Christmas time. We've got a new ship lined up, but we don't just know what the freight charges will be. At this point, it's $160 a cubic metre for everything that comes onto the island. So when you do the volume of a caravan, just kills
Which
you.
Which is really dead air.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Kills you.
I suppose you could fill the caravan up with freight if you wanted to. Jim Benn speaking with Margot Kelly about why you'd choose to build an art studio from scratch or a caravan on King Island, with freight costs a big consideration for all industries on the island. We also heard from Andrew Blake there. Details of our stories online at abc.net.au/rural, and you can visit our Tasmanian Country Hour Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter at Taz Country Hour, the hour spelled HR.